This video is sponsored by Squarespace. More about them in just a moment.
We're back with some more wonderful and informative philosophy memes. So let's get started. My name is Joe Folley, and this is Unsolicited Advice. Okay, next up we have a meme by NoAssignment5718, and it's a picture of the lungs, and they go, I breathe air for you. A picture of the heart, and it says, I pump blood for you. A picture of the liver, and it says, I filter waste for you. And a picture of the brain, and it says, what if I'm in a vat? So, obviously, this is, to a certain extent, just a tongue-in-cheek jab at the kinds of tormenting philosophical questions that your brain can come up with, seemingly just for the fun of giving you just a little bit of mental torment to get you through the day. But this also touches upon, I think, a very important idea that comes up in a surprising amount of philosophies, which is this general sense that what if consciousness is either a mistake or a byproduct, an epiphenomenal and thus ephemeral byproduct of just your body's general functioning. That is, that consciousness, I think Nietzsche says this at some point, that consciousness is, to a certain extent, just a kind of thing going on that doesn't really have anything causal to do with the way that the body conducts itself. Your consciousness is just a sort of a thing going on over the top of all of these causal processes. And because many things seem like they are caused by your conscious mind, you then fool yourself into thinking that these are conscious decisions that you've taken when, in fact, it's just the unconscious bubbling away underneath the surface. And there are many people who interpret Nietzsche that way. One who doesn't is Paul Katsafanis, who reserves a causal role for the conscious mind. I think another philosopher who broadly is quite pessimistic about the brain and consciousness's role in human well-being and also just value in general, is just very down on consciousness, is Emile Cioran. And I think Thomas Ligotti also makes this point, which is that for both of them, so much suffering is caused by consciousness. The ability to self-reflect has been, in some ways, a huge evolutionary success, right? It allows for long-term planning. It allows for us to evaluate ourselves from a distance and work out what to change and how to improve in line with whatever we are looking to strive for. And you can see how that would be really quite handy. However, also, the ability to take ourselves as an object of evaluation, or in other words, just to see ourselves as a self-conscious object in the world. God, I sound like a French philosopher. A self-conscious object in the world is itself going to lead to quite a lot of suffering further down the line. So, I mean, one way of thinking about this, I made this point in a video about self-awareness, is that humans have kind of a unique problem in the animal kingdom, which is that we can get too in our own heads about things. I'm accused of this a lot, and I would certainly agree with those accusations. They're absolutely dead on the money. I am quite often too stuck in my own head. And I think that a lot of us will recognize this feeling of being too caught in your own head and thus failing to interact smoothly and pleasantly with the world. I remember a friend put it like this, and I think it's quite an illuminating thing to puzzle over, even if I don't necessarily think it's absolutely right. He put it to me that the times when you are most happy are times when you are not aware of yourself at all. And I think this is broadly true. There are a couple of exceptions that I can think of. One is when you have done something that you feel accomplished about, and then you can enter into your own awareness as a source of happiness and of joy and of being pleased with yourself, rather than simply bringing yourself up for self-evaluation and then beating yourself with your moralistic stick, which is, I think, what we do quite a lot of the time. But that's one scenario where I think self-consciousness and joy go together. But I do think he's got a pretty good point, which is that quite a lot of our most pleasurable experiences are specifically when we are not aware of ourselves, and instead our whole conscious experience is absorbed in a single task or a single activity. This is a point that's also sort of tangentially made, I suppose, by Mihai Csikszentmihalyi in his work on flow states. One of the characteristics of a flow state is that you're totally absorbed in activity. And while I don't think he dwells on this too much, although it's been a long time since I've read him, so this may be just completely wrong, something that falls out of this, at the very least, even if it's not Csikszentmihalyi's focus, is that if you're fully absorbed in a task, you cannot think about yourself, because all of your energy is in the task in front of you. I have this with writing. Writing is my standard flow state activity, if that makes sense. I'm pretty much always at my happiest when I'm writing. And one of the characteristic states of writing for me, when I'm totally absorbed in it, is that I become transparent to myself. I just have the act of putting thoughts on the page, and I can see my thoughts, but I don't see me, if that makes sense. I feel like this is gesturing at something that I just can't quite put into words, but I think that many of you will sort of know what I mean with your own particular flow state activities, which is that, again, you just kind of don't become aware of yourself as an object or as a person. And there are a lot of spiritual traditions that focus on this, right? Some Christian meditative traditions. I think that this is in Desert Father work, though I'm not 100% sure, so I wouldn't take that as read. And I also, for the record, wouldn't take anything I say in these casual videos particularly seriously. But certainly in some Christian mystic meditative literature, and certainly in a lot of Buddhist meditative literature, the point is to forget yourself, to become non-self-conscious, not in the kind of colloquial sense, but in a sort of deeper philosophical sense of losing sight of yourself within your own conscious horizon, which sounds very woo-y. But again, I do think that most of us will have experienced this at some point, and I do think that it is an extreme source of joy. So to that extent, I do think that this meme has a point in that I think that there is the potential for the brain or the mind, with all of its wonderful higher order thinking apparatus, to make us much, much sadder. And to that extent, maybe Charan was right. Maybe it is the case that the conscious mind is a mistake, and that actually we would do much better if we didn't have this conscious thing going on, and really we just let the unconscious machinery, well, obviously we can't do this, but it would have been better if we'd have been evolved without this conscious stuff going on, and the unconscious machinery would just have taken over, and that would have been the smooth, unfrictious running of the organic machine, I suppose. I don't know if I agree with that. I do think that it is hilarious in some ways that the thing that has made humans so evolutionarily successful, our mental, the sophistication of our mental architecture, has at the same time managed to cause us an immense amount of uniquely human suffering. I'd still rather be a human than any other animal. I just think that's a lovely tidbit. What a piece of irony. If there is a God, he has a sense of humor. But before moving on, I just want to take a quick moment to thank today's sponsor, Squarespace. If you're looking to build a website, then you'll know it can be a real hassle. First, you have to find a domain name and then construct the entire thing. And there's always this underlying fear that you're messing it up and creating something that doesn't just look untidy, but outright unprofessional. But this is where Squarespace comes into play. They take all of that complexity and compress it down into a single platform, using ready-made templates to extract all of the complication and pain out of website building. Their block-based Fluid Engine editing system is also so easy to use and makes it very simple to integrate anything you want into your website without having to master some elaborate coding language. Head to squarespace.com/unsolicited advice and use the code unsolicitedadvice to get 10% off your first purchase of a domain name or a website. But anyway, back to the video. We have a meme by Tree4677, and it's a dad talking to his daughter, and the daughter says, "Dad, I've decided to major in philosophy." And the dad replies, "That's good, because they just opened that huge philosophy factory in our town." And I can only assume that that is a sarcastic reply from the father. I don't know of any philosophy factories, though if you do want to open one, then please do drop me an email. Yeah, you get this a lot if you decide to do a philosophy degree or broadly show an interest in philosophy. There are a couple of things that I would generally say. One is that, obviously, philosophy majors do go on to work non-philosophy jobs. The amount of people whose university degree ends up being directly relevant to the job that they then go on to do is pretty small in quite a lot of degrees, and especially in non-technical degrees or non-STEM degrees, just because, you know, quite a lot of people... I'll think back to my cohort. So out of the people that I know from my course, a few are teachers, a few went into the civil service, a few are now in management positions at various different companies. You know, it's a huge spectrum. A lot of them are working in philosophy in some capacity, be it as a PhD or now a few of them have finished PhDs. And, you know, I run this channel. I couldn't do that without my philosophy degree, though I think that's a pretty skewed sample. No one else from my cohort has decided to go down the route of being a YouTuber. I wonder why. And personally, I suppose I have mixed feelings about whether one ought to go and take a philosophy degree, because, you know, there are probably more employable degrees. But at the same time, I absolutely loved mine. It was some of my greatest memories are from that period. I loved being in a philosophy department and having debates with other people on my course and getting to spend all my time in the library. In many ways, the reason that I love my job now and all of the things that I love about my job are just all the things that I did and had when I was a student. I also now get to spend all my time reading old books and talking about them to people, and that is a lot of fun. So if you are thinking about doing a philosophy degree, I would say I certainly really enjoyed mine, but yes, there are probably downsides to do with employment and all sorts. And do be prepared to answer this question of what are you going to do with a philosophy degree an awful lot. That being said, I would gently push back on the idea that the sole purpose of higher education is employability. But to further push back against that pushback, I would say that is to a certain extent kind of a take you can only have in a particular situation, right? Employment is important because it is how you get the money that you need to live. So I do take people's point, and I do broadly agree with people's point where they say employment shouldn't necessarily be your sole focus when you're thinking about university. But ultimately, it's got a feature in there somewhere, right? But, you know, as I said, I really enjoyed my philosophy degree, and to that extent, I do recommend it, I suppose. But yes, you will answer this question an awful lot, and I would gently suggest not saying I'm going to become a philosophy YouTuber. I didn't even mean to become a philosophy YouTuber. What I planned to do with my philosophy degree was to take a couple of years out and then apply for PhDs and then go into that and just go from there. And the channel has been just such a wonderful interlude, I suppose. I plan to sort of ride this train until it stops. All social media success is inevitably fleeting. And then I hope to go into teaching and get a part-time philosophy PhD along the side of that, if I can, which would be wonderful. That's kind of my long-term plan, I suppose. I always think that one should be very nervous about setting one's stock in any kind of internet success. It is ephemeral and will evaporate before your eyes if you're not careful. Everyone falls off eventually. Right, here we have a meme by Carrot Top Guy, and it's captioned, "That's cute, I'm trying to govern a nation, Machiavelli." And it's a picture of Machiavelli, and the top text is, "Cool morality, bro." And the bottom text is, "You think everyone will agree to follow it?" And yeah, there's definitely something in this that I think is reflective of some of Machiavelli's thoughts, right? However, I do think that it is important, in my opinion, at least, you know, people can test this, but I think it's very important not to just think of Machiavelli as someone with absolutely no moral philosophy or no ethics in the traditional sense. Machiavelli really has quite a lot of strong values that come forth in at least the discourses and to a certain extent in the prints and the bits of the Florentine histories that I've read. Erica Benner talks an awful lot about this. And while I don't necessarily agree with everything that Erica Benner says, I think she's absolutely dead on the money with this point, which is that Machiavelli in some ways has an incredibly strong sense of civic virtue. He repeatedly and emphatically argues for the establishment of strong civic institutions within states, be they republics or principalities, and he really values freedom. Like, he really values freedom. He seems to view it as, it would be too highfalutin, I guess, to call it a good in and of itself, but he intensely values it. It really comes across, at the very least, in the implicit and sometimes the explicit things that he favors. So one of the reasons why he values republics is because he thinks that they can be freer and that being freer is a really good thing. So one of his critiques of monarchies is that you can't let the citizens be free, because if the citizens are free, they're going to want to partake in the government. And if you're a monarchy, you can't allow that. So he has this whole analysis of the Kingdom of France. And Machiavelli's pretty positive about the Kingdom of France. It's probably the most positive he ever gets about monarchical or principality-style states. States without any kind of public engagement with the government. He largely thinks that because France has pretty strong institutions at this time, it's a very orderly and a very stable and a very safe state. Kind of ironic considering, you know, the French Revolution that would happen a few hundred years later, but I don't think we could expect Machiavelli to have predicted that. But one of the critiques he does level at the French state, there's a paper that talks about this that I've mentioned in other videos, but I can't remember who wrote it now, is that the French people can't be free. They can't be free because they would then be a threat to the government if they were free. And not only does this undermine the stability of the state in some ways, in that they cannot rely on those people to be kind of armed, semi-informal militias, right? They can't expect them to really defend against invaders out of anything other than a sense of mere self-preservation. And this kind of weakens the external security of France. But also because Machiavelli thinks it is good for citizens to be free. He does have an idea of what it makes, what it takes to be a good state and what it takes to have a good human life. There are points in the discourses where he's talking all about kind of touching upon what the education of a virtuous person ought to be, why he thinks that the citizens of Rome were more virtuous than his contemporary Italian Renaissance citizens. He's not totally disinterested in virtue. But the thing that I think this meme does get really spot on is that virtue isn't causative for Machiavelli. And to be fair, I mean, it's not like many philosophers have argued for an enormously causative role of morality itself, separate from any actions one takes in furtherance of that morality. But I think, yeah, this does touch upon the fact that for Machiavelli, it is important to stay realistic in how you will try and bring about your ideal virtuous situation, right? That's one of the reasons why his discourses and the Prince is full of practical advice on how to maintain the security of the state. And especially in the discourses, practical advice on how to better the citizens in the state in kind of like a straightforward, down-to-earth, concrete, linear causal sense. So I don't know. I think on the one hand, we can go too far and end up saying that Machiavelli has no moral sensibility or no interest in virtue. And I really think that would be a mistake. Chapters 4, 5, and 6 of Machiavelli's Ethics by Erica Benner just like, completely blows this out of the water, in my opinion. I think that's those are probably my favorite bits of the book. And they're my favorite bits of the book because of this. They do just, I think, establish that Machiavelli has a real sense of virtue and prizes civic virtue and has a kind of political philosophy in terms of what he thinks a good state is, separate from what he thinks a merely functional state is, if that makes sense. But on the other hand, you know, Machiavelli's not an idealist. Like there's not nothing in the picture of Machiavelli as the realpolitik guy. He still is in many ways, I think at least, the realpolitik guy. You know, him and Thucydides are often mentioned in a pair together, and I think that's quite a natural pair to make. At the same time, Machiavelli is much more he wears his morality on his sleeve a lot more than Thucydides. I think you could make an argument that Thucydides does have clearly some kind of implicit virtue vice theory churning away in the background, just in how he presents certain things. Like Thucydides does his best to be to show things from different people's perspectives, but I don't know, he doesn't have the most pro-Athenian stance in the world for quite a lot of it. Then again, he is our main source, so I kind of don't know how we check that. But back to Machiavelli, I think this meme gets to something very important about Machiavelli, but I would hazard against going the whole hog, so to speak, and viewing Machiavelli as having no interest in virtue or no interest in morality or no interest in what it takes to be a good state rather than a merely prudent state, let's call it. I think, yeah, that it's important not to fall into either camps there, at least in my opinion. I don't know. I could be wrong. Moving on. Okay, our next meme is by HO6.org, and it's three rows of people sitting in a classroom, and the lecturer says, "I'm a whole ass MFing freak lol. I'm talking sucking toes, eating all of it." And then the person in the second row says, "I think I'm in the wrong class. Which classroom is French philosophy?" And then the person at the back row says, "This is French philosophy." I don't know much French philosophy, if I'm honest. Well, I know a little bit, but I imagine this is talking about the kind of mid to late 20th century French philosophy that is just notoriously hard to understand. Every time I try, I'm just beaten back. In fact, to give you an example of just how kind of weird and counterintuitive and difficult to understand it can get, I was struggling with this. So I asked some of my friends who are much more familiar with mid to late 20th century French philosophy, to just kind of give me some pointers on where to start, because I kept picking up well-known French theorist stroke philosophy books and kind of getting through a couple of pages being like, it's not just that I don't understand this, it's that I don't even know how I could go about understanding this were I to look at the page longer and try and tease it through. Whereas, you know, there are plenty of difficult texts where you think, oh, this is going to take me a good few reads to understand. With a lot of mid to late 20th century French philosophy, I would open it and I go, I think I could stare at this until the heat death of the universe and I would just be no closer to understanding what on earth this person's going on about. So I asked a friend where I should start. And she said, I should start with Jacques Lacan. So I tried to read some of his essays and that was... I was not prepared. So I got the Cambridge Introduction to Jacques Lacan, thinking this will really help, right? This will be the way I will finally crack a type of philosophy that I have always found totally impenetrable. And the very first line of the preface, I don't think you can read it, but the very first line of the preface is, Jacques Lacan is the most misunderstood theorist of the 20th century. So the guy that I had been recommended as a kind of get in to this style of philosophy, considering that so many other thinkers rely on his thought so much, is apparently the most misunderstood thinker of the 20th century. So I don't know. This is going to be a long-running quest for me to try and figure out what the hell all of those French people are going on about. Because, like, very, very clever people that I know and very clever people that I have read praise a lot of these kind of mid to late 20th century French thinkers. They think they're brilliant. And I, again, find them totally impenetrable, with the possible exception of Foucault, who some bits of him I think are actually very straightforward. Well, not straightforward, but like you can puzzle through it. So I will keep you updated on how this particular quest goes. But that was at once very comforting and deeply terrifying, because this is where I'm starting and I'm already being told that everything here is going to be terribly confusing. And yeah, I mean, I don't know. As I say, I'll let you know. I probably won't make a video on any of this for like a year on the basis that it's going to take me forever to understand it. And then it's going to take me forever to understand it to the point where I feel like I can write a video on it. So, but yeah, I relate to this idea of not quite knowing what's going on with French philosophy. Also, French philosophy just has like a lot of weird sex stuff. Again, I'm sure I'll get to that once I've plowed my way through Lacan and have to moving on to these other eminent philosophers. I relate to the guy who thinks he's in the wrong class. I too think that I'm in the wrong class. But, you know, this is part of learning new things. It's always good fun. Okay, next up we have a meme by Timmy Tissue, and it reads, r/philosophy memes users picking their worldview, and it's Squidward and the fish. And the fish says, I'll have a determinism, atheism and physicalism. And Squidward says, how original. And utilitarianism. And Squidward says, daring today, aren't we? Yeah, I think that online, at the very least, these positions just kind of tend to go together. One of the things that I've been trying to show in a few of my videos, and I did this a little bit in my video on the problem of reason, which I can't, it must have been almost a year since I put that out. But anyway, one of the things I tried to do there, and one of the things I'm consistently trying to do with this channel, is to kind of emphasize that these positions don't go together necessarily. For example, Calvinists are theist determinists. The Stoics are theist determinists. Well, compatibilists, but they're theistic determinists. It's, you don't have to be an atheist in order to think about think there's no free will and to think that all events are determined. Also, you don't need to be a physicalist and an atheist. There are plenty of non-physicalist atheist thinkers throughout history. Schopenhauer is a non-physicalist atheist thinker, right? He doesn't believe in a god, but he believes in the will, which is, at the very least, it's not something that would be amenable to a modern atheist materialist worldview. But he doesn't believe in God. Philosophy doesn't bifurcate into the kind of hardcore materialist atheist camp and the kind of theist camp, where theism here just means one of the major world religions. There is just an enormous amount of conceptual scope here, or conceptual space, sorry, in order for people to explore the middle ground between these parts. So one interesting position, which I see almost no one take, outside of philosophy at the very least, is mere theism or something like that. I don't quite have a good word for it. I'm saying mere theism because of C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. Mere theism would be the minimal amount of things that you need to believe in order to be a theist. So a mere theist wouldn't believe in any of the major world religions. They would just be a little bit more than a deist and significantly less than most of the major world religions. I think that's a very interesting philosophical position. I don't personally buy into it, but I just like bringing these to the fore because I think they just get skated over. There aren't many people that believe in them, but there aren't many people that believe in them, not necessarily for philosophical reasons, just for contingent historical reasons. Okay, another one is like Gnosticism, right? Gnosticism, many people don't believe in Gnosticism, but it's not necessarily because they've heard of Gnosticism and have rejected it in favor of traditional perennialist Christian theology. It's because Gnosticism was branded a heresy and stamped out by actual religious persecution, right? And there are plenty of positions that, in a similar vein, we don't have floating around in public consciousness anymore, not because they are inherently less tenable than the major world religions, but because for contingent, totally unphilosophical reasons, they have just died out. People stopped believing in them. I know, I maybe it's just kind of personal affection. I like exploring these. The other thing I wanted to say is that utilitarianism is an interesting addendum to these, because I would suspect that somebody who's an atheist and a physicalist and a determinist in this kind of modern materialist sense, I suppose, are often amenable to anti-realist pictures of meta-ethics and are often reasonably quietist about the ethical level. So in some ways, I think that I'm surprised that the utilitarianism sneaks in there. But having said that, every atheist I know who does take, actually, not quite, almost every atheist I know who does take a definite position on moral matters is a utilitarian. There are a few exceptions. I know an atheist virtue ethicist, which is really cool. Virtue ethics is, I think, fantastic and deeply underexplored online. I mean, it was underexplored for centuries, and then it was kind of resurrected in the mid-20th century, which I think was fantastic. I think virtue ethics is a slightly different way of approaching the problem of morality in general, but I think it's brilliant. I'm excited to plug it whenever I can. And, you know, there's no particular reason why someone who's an atheist, a physicalist, and a determinist would be utilitarian over virtue ethics. I can see how they would be a utilitarian over something like Kantianism. But I don't necessarily think that they need to be utilitarian over modern Kantian constructivist ethicists like, you know, Christine Korsgaard's position. Right? I feel like I'm always banging on about Christine Korsgaard on this channel. I think it's partly just because she makes a lot of Kantian ethics much more plausible from an atheist perspective. So yeah, I don't know. I think that these positions often go together, but they only go together through mere correlation. There's not necessarily a philosophical link between all of them. And I think that's important to bear in mind. You don't need to be a determinist if you're an atheist. You don't need to be a physicalist if you're an atheist. And you don't need to be utilitarian if you are an atheist who takes a stance on normative first order ethical matters. But anyway, on to the next one. Okay, next we have a meme by Trend Socialist, and it's a couple of screenshots from Fantastic Four. And Mr. Fantastic says, "We attempted to negotiate, but Galactus, he asked too high a price." And someone else says, "Well, what does he want?" And Mr. Fantastic says, "He asked us to actually read someone before we disagree with them." Yeah, I mean, I think this happens a fair amount. I've certainly been guilty of this from time to time in the past, where I just kind of, you hear a lot about a philosopher, and then you think, oh yeah, I kind of know what this philosopher thinks, especially if you've heard about them from very reputable sources, like sometimes, you know, professors. And then you go and read their work, kind of expecting that, oh yeah, this viewpoint you've been told about them will be confirmed. And then actually things are a lot more complicated than that. You'd be surprised at how much straw manning is completely unintentional. One of the reasons why I think that studying the history of philosophy can be so difficult at times is because oftentimes you are approaching a particular thinker with hundreds and hundreds of years of built up interpretive lenses that you're then kind of inadvertently looking at them through. And sometimes those interpretive lenses can be really misleading, right? It, just because misconceptions can build up over time, just as much as straightforward conceptions can build up over time. We talked about Machiavelli earlier, right? This is such an example of where that has happened. You've got hundreds of years of anti-Machiavelli propaganda going in when you look at Machiavelli. And that means that even when you go and read him, quite often his Republican principles can just get papered over because your pre-existing frame affects what you will cognitively pick out, right? That sounds very abstract, but it's kind of simple, right? If you're expecting to read Machiavelli and encounter a kind of despot apologist, then when you're reading The Prince, your mind is going to be drawn to those parts that are kind of could be interpreted as pro-despotism, and it's going to ignore the parts that seem pretty anti-despotism. And this can happen for a whole range of thinkers, right? It happens with Nietzsche a fair amount, right? You go through Nietzsche and it's sometimes difficult to exactly pick out when he's being metaphorical, because we've got this image of Nietzsche swimming around in our public consciousness that he's just kind of a bastard. And it's very difficult to separate yourself from that when you go and read him. And it happens with whole swaths of thinkers. So a really good example of this, actually, I wrote a blog post recently about the philosopher A.J. Ayer and what I took to be just kind of an almost conspiratorial level of strawmanning of his position that he puts forward in Language, Truth, and Logic. For those of you who aren't that familiar with A.J. Ayer, he's a fantastic thinker. I highly recommend checking him out. He argues that statements are only literally significant, and that's a technical term for him, if they are either verifiable or they are true by definitions. They're a tautology. People often say, an argument that people often give against this is, okay, well, Mr. Ayer, or Dr. Ayer, Professor Ayer, is that statement itself, the statement that statements are only literally significant if and only if they are either empirically verifiable or they are true by definition. Is that statement empirically verifiable or true by definition? And, you know, the implied answer is no. And as a result, A.J. Ayer's entire edifice collapses. Now, as it happens, I don't agree with A.J. Ayer about that point. But that's for kind of for later reasons. But this critique is still given. But if you read Language, Truth, and Logic, it does define literally significant along these lines. That statement is a truth by definition within the definitions that he gives in Language, Truth, and Logic. So there's nothing literally insignificant about it. Ayer has defined literal significance along these lines, and then he's just stating that definition. And when he defends that definition, he does something really interesting, which lots of philosophers do. And it's incredible, I think, that more people don't pick up on it. Although I think one of the reasons why I pick up on it, maybe sometimes even where it's not there that much, is because I'm very into philosophical pragmatism, and especially the pragmatism of people like Peirce and Ramsey. Well, later Ramsey, as much as you can talk about later Ramsey, because he died so tragically young. Well, one of the things that becomes very apparent at the beginning of Language, Truth, and Logic is that A.J. Ayer is advancing this verification principle and this definition of literal significance because he thinks it will be really useful. He talks about kind of fruitful and fruitless inquiry. And once you have that on the table, his argument is significantly less ridiculous. As I say, it still doesn't work for a variety of reasons, but the claim that's often put forward, and this is on the A-level philosophy syllabus in the UK, which one of the reasons why I think it persists so much is because people are taught this misinterpretation again and again and again as years go on, and then it's very difficult to not read that misinterpretation back into Ayer. People put forward this idea that Ayer was just advancing a contradiction in terms. He was undermining his own principle when he gave it. And he just wasn't doing that. Like it's just not in the text. And that's a really good example of where particular conceptions of philosophers or particular claims about what philosophers said get so kind of worm their way so firmly into the kind of things that are taught to you at kind of first year undergrad level of philosophy. And the vast majority of thinkers that you'll learn in first year undergrad philosophy, you probably won't revisit. So a really good example, right, is that I was taught Rawls in first year undergrad philosophy. And I have not revisited Rawls, and I've not revisited much political philosophy really at all, apart from for like historical interests. In the past, I was pretty confident, not in the channel because I didn't cover him, but like just in general conversation, I was pretty confident talking about what Rawls said. And this experience of reading A.J. Ayer and realizing just how strawmanned he is, even within academic circles. Like, I've heard professors give this argument against air, and as far as I can tell, it just rests on a deeply uncharitable and straw-manning reading of his text. As a result, I no longer talk about Rawls, because I think, oh yeah, but I imagine that when I learnt that at first year undergrad, that was probably as much learning about this kind of encrusted bed of interpretive accumulated debris that may or may not be representative of what you'd actually encounter in the text, as it was learning about what Rawls himself wrote. And I know, I think it's always important to bear that in mind when we are learning philosophy secondhand, including on this channel, right? Because I am giving you my interpretation of various different thinkers, or other academics' interpretations of various different thinkers, if I've cited an academic in my video. But that's not the same as reading the text yourself, right? Because it's entirely possible that I'm going into a particular thinker with my own particular cognitive biases and preconceptions that's causing me to potentially pick out or prioritize certain aspects of their thought over certain others. And that's something that you can't help but do when you're reading something. But it does mean that my reading is going to be different to your reading. And I think this is just vitally important. I mean, it shouldn't be like massively controversial to say that it's worth reading a philosopher before embarking on some great critique of them. But I think it does bear repeating. And I think that it's worth acknowledging the shortcomings of formats like this, where someone else is letting you know their own interpretation of a philosopher. Inevitably, I'll be missing things out, and sometimes I'm purposefully simplifying things and I let you know what I am. It won't be the same experience. I don't think it'll be nearly as valuable as going and reading the philosophers for yourself. You know, I try and keep these videos educational, entertaining, but ultimately it's not a substitute for going and wrestling with the texts in your own time. I'm writing a video about kind of the effect of the internet on thinking, because it's something that I've been thinking a lot about. And one of the things that it kind of gave me a bit of a self-reflective crisis, I suppose, because, okay, like my ideal for this channel is to introduce people to different philosophers and different ways of thinking. And so hopefully those who are interested can check those out for themselves and kind of go into more detail about them. What I kind of have been trying to emphasize more and more as I've been thinking about this impact of internet content and kind of edutainment content, I suppose it's called, online, emphasizing and re-emphasizing this fact that this isn't a substitution for reading such thinkers for yourself and doing your own thinking on the subject, because this kind of content really does have a place, as long as it doesn't replace the really important kind of self-educational work of actually reading texts and engaging with them consciously and actively. So I don't know, I think I'll probably be emphasizing that quite a lot from now on, in the same way that I emphasize that, you know, I'm not an expert and that this is just my interpretation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I really want to kind of bring the focus of the channel to re-emphasizing over and over again how important it is to engage with these texts for yourself, should you want to. I don't know if that was particularly relevant to the meme, but yeah, I do think it's important to read people before you disagree with them. So it makes a good point. Right, that's all we've got time for today. Thank you so much for watching. If you want to catch any of the previous episodes in this meme series, you can find them right here. Thank you so much for watching again, and have a wonderful day.